time with Uncaged.
Welcome to Topple Uncaged. I'm Steve Topple, and over the next 20 minutes, I'll be bringing you the quickest firing news roundup of the week. I'll be getting down and dirty with a very special guest going through some big stories. I'll be taking a part of this week's Question Time, and also I'll be bringing you some of the biggest, most banging political tunes going. So, lock and load, people. Let's go.
Uncaged.
What's up, everyone? I am Steve Topple. It is Sunday, the 13th of January, 2019, and that can only mean one thing. It's this week's edition of Topple Uncaged. Yes, who knew that, according to rumours, well, one's going round in my head anyway, Countdown is the hottest new political show on the television, and it's easy to see why. If we put the letters game into politics, you had Michael Gove saying bollocks in Parliament this week. Plus, you had Amber Rudd using some clever semantics about her changes to universal credit, trying to disguise the fact that there's been no changes at all. Meanwhile, over on the numbers round, you had Theresa May braving it in Liverpool, announcing the details of her £20.5 billion worth of investment for the NHS. But you know the biggest Topple Uncaged conundrum of all this week? It's who knew that Rachel Riley knew so much about politics? Anyway, on with this week's show, and of course, as usual, I'll be giving you the quickest firing news roundup in the UK. I have a very, very special guest this week to go through some of the top stories. I will, of course, be taking a part and taking down this week's Question Time with Fiona Bruce, nonetheless. And there will be a very special musical guest to finish it all off. So, before I get taken to Dictionary Corner and spanked rotten with a copy of a thesaurus, let's get on with this week's show. The fastest news segment in the UK, it's Plucked News. I'm surprised I've got any teeth left after 9 episodes of Topple Uncaged, because yes, it's that time of the week again, it is Plucked News. 5 news stories, 5 minutes, can I fit them all in? I think I can. In 3, 2, 1. Let's go, and first off, we're up to universal credit, and I'm not going to one particular story because there has been so many this week, it's been an absolute clusterfuck. First off, Amber Rudd on Monday announced that she was cancelling the parliamentary vote on managed migration, and instead putting to them a vote about the 10,000 claimants which would be in part of a trial. The media touted this as some sort of revelation and backtracking from Rudd, but it wasn't actually. Esther McVeigh announced it in October 2018. Then on Thursday, she said she was scrapping the two-child limit on universal credit for babies that were born before April 2017. Once again, the story was pushed that something is absolutely not. This will only benefit a few thousand families, whereas nearly 800,000 families will be in for the cut still. Then on Friday, there was a triple whammy. Amber Rudd lost the court case against 4 women who were claiming that they were worse off under universal credit. The judge agreed. After that, the department quietly stuck out that it was making changes to the severe disability premium and universal credit. All of this without parliamentary approval, I hasten to add. Labour's Debbie Abrahams is up in arms. Check out her Twitter feed. And last but not least, on Friday, Amber Rudd had the audacity to say that she thought the horror stories about universal credit were confined to one or two people. Look, Amber, it's very straightforward. There are so many fucking holes in universal credit that you can't fix it. Why are there so many holes? Because it is broken by design. It's intended to inflict misery, poverty, and unprecedented torture on millions of people. You can't fix something that's so fucking broken. Story number two, and we're off to BBC News, and they reported that hungry children eating from school bins in Morecambe. This is the story of the head teacher in Morecambe who says that 1 in 10 of her pupils' parents are having to use food banks and that some children are coming to school rooting through bins for apple cores. This, of course, Amber Rudd, has nothing to do with the last story on universal credit. No, nothing to see here. But this is a damning indictment of the country. But sadly, this story is not new. We keep hearing pitiful tales of children going to school starving hungry. My concern is with the kind of story, it is becoming normalised. We see them day in, day out, along with stories of horror from benefit claimants, while all the while nothing really changes. As we've seen in story number one, just piecemeal token gestures from the Department for Work and Pensions and the government. I'm really beginning to believe that we've gone past the point of no return now with this. We need a general election this year and we do need a Corbyn government, but will that solve the problem? I'm not 100% convinced. Next up, story number three, and I'm off to the excellent Watching the Hawks on RT America. They reported that US troops are now in Africa. Shock horror. Specifically, that US Special Forces have been sent into Gabon to monitor the situation in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where there's been a massive uprising after the presidential elections. Now, this story is very curious, because as soon as US troups went into Gabon, there was an attempted coup by the military. What's that all about? The government managed to overthrow this coup and stop it from happening, but this is very concerning. However, what you need to watch with this story is it is the future of things to come. With Trump pulling out of Syria, and the majority of Middle Eastern countries now being Western controlled, Africa is the final frontier for imperialist governments. We're going to be seeing more and more of this over the next few years, not least because countries like the Democratic Republic of Congo have huge reserves of copper and other minerals used in the manufacture of mobile phones. Trust me, Africa is the final frontier. It's going to be a repeat of the Middle East and 20th century. And for story number 4, I'm off to Twitter, and Rosie at The Little Lefty tweeted, "Thank you, the Canary UK, at Mr. Topple, for writing this article about my campaign for children's mental health. It's an issue that I'm very passionate about." This is Rosie, who started a petition campaigning for more money to be put into children and adolescent mental health services, CAMHS. And the figures behind this story are absolutely shocking. Referrals in the past 5 years to CAMHS have increased by 26%, but at the same time, in 2017-18, CAMHS rejected 55,000 referrals. That's over 150 children a day not getting the support they need. Meanwhile, between 2010 and 2015, NHS England cut around 50 million from children's mental health services. That is a 6% real terms drop. And even when the government pledged to spend more money, a report by Young Minds found that councils were still not spending the money they were being given on children's mental health services. They were ferreting it off elsewhere. And all of this is without the absolutely staggering waiting times, where over 8% of children have to wait over a year for treatment for mental health issues. So please, 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 follow the link in the show notes, go and sign Rosie's petition. She has had an awful lot of shit on Twitter this week, mentioning no names. So please support her. It's a great cause, great petition, and she's a great young lady. And last but not least, I'm back to the Canary. In a brilliant article by John McAvoy, he wrote that Justin Trudeau's tears are worthless. This week's assault shows he's just another corporate stooge. This is the story of the Canadian government pushing through a gas pipeline through Indigenous people's land. The Wet'suwet'en's territory in the west of Canada is being invaded by the government, who have got out a court order saying they have to accept a gas pipeline through it. On the 7th of January, Trudeau sent in mounted police to try and disperse them and get them off the land so this pipeline can go through. Author and journalist Naomi Klein tweeted, "It's a shameful day in Canada's history," while all the time Trudeau was just basically sobbing the tears of a clown. This story shows two things for me. Firstly, that for all his liberal values, Trudeau is nothing but another fucking neocon who puts fossil fuel interests above those of the people. But secondly, it shows the mess that Western governments are in over climate change. They spout all this nonsense at Paris, saying that we're going to change, we must change, the climate is in chaos. And yet here we are in Canada, they're pushing through another gas pipeline. This is one story to watch because I believe it is going to blow up. Check out Naomi Klein's feed for more information. And in that time to talk about Trump saying that his Mexican war will stop the illegal drugs flows and drug deaths in America, drug deaths that he says are more than the Vietnam War death toll combined. Actually, Trump, that's not strictly true. 2/3 of drug deaths in America are from pharmaceutical opioids. You really should check your facts before making such claims, Trump, but then why break the habit of a lifetime? Nor have I time to talk about that the first person has been arrested in the Panama Papers scandal. Remember that? We've all conveniently forgotten about it, haven't we? But no, this person is not a banker or a politician. This person is a journalist in Turkey who was arrested for reporting the truth. Yes, that's right. They're banging up people in Turkey now for reporting the truth. Shock horror there. But really, where are the bankers going to jail in this scandal? I don't think we're ever going to see that though, are we? And nor have I had time to talk about dear little Owen Jones, who's been on the television more this week than I've had hot dinners. Yes, nice little learning for him when he was attacked by the far right. But what he's actually done is gone on with this narrative that it's the mainstream media that were responsible for the rise and the rhetoric surrounding the far right. Owen managed to absolve Thatcher's deindustrialization and the triangulation of Blair and Clinton in the 90s, plus political correctness gone mad, for any blame for why working class white communities are so pissed off and why they're turning to the likes of fascist Tommy Robinson. But of course, Owen saying that wouldn't get you on the telly, would it? And hadn't had time to say anything about Andy Murray quitting tennis. I'm just waiting to see if the press are going to call him a British tennis player now or a Scottish one. I think it's probably going to be the latter. That is it. Plug news done for another week. I'm off to... No, I'm not, because we need to get straight into the next section. Dissecting this week's top stories, it's me, free-flying with... It's a rather strange turn of events on this week's edition of Free Flying With, because instead of interviewing me, which this next guest normally does, I've turned the tables on him and I'm interviewing him. It is the irrepressible, the fantastic Afshin Ratanzi, host of one of the best news programmes on British television, Going Underground. Afshin, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. This is a real pleasure.
Thank you for inviting me, although I'm not sure about this new power relationship here. You get to ask questions. It's not fair.
I will be perfectly passive-aggressive, Afshin. As always with this section, we have three stories to rattle through. The first one is picked by Afshin himself. The second one is a story I have decided on. And the third story is, as always, decided by you good people on Twitter. So, Afshin, we're going to kick off with your story. And this was a session in Parliament on Monday where MPs were debating Philip Alston's UN report on poverty in the UK. Now, the London Economic did a quick roundup of this story, and they said that only 14 MPs turned out to debate this. Are we at the point now where sort of this grinding poverty and extreme deprivation is becoming normalised? The very fact that so few MPs even could be bothered to turn up to this debate, do you think that shows that? Are we at that stage now?
Well, either it shows that our MPs really are one in a million, because I think then the number of MPs that turned up means, what, each one represented a million? I mean, the idea, and I got to shout out to Philip Alston and his UN team, because we're trying to get them on the show, going underground. They haven't gone back to us. Okay. But the idea of even a minister for hunger, what, just one of them? So the rest of the cabinet and the other ministers could just not care about hunger at all. I mean, we're in the middle of winter here in Britain. That means, what, tens of thousands of so-called excess deaths, according to the National Statistics Office. Yeah. We've got 40,000 that are going to die this year because of air pollution, the kind of tiny particles that you can't see, unlike pollution in China that they always show. And meanwhile, this kind of hunger problem that just isn't represented in anything in our media, whether it be our television media, our entertainment media, our news media, even in our music. Every aspect of British society is not reflecting the utter deprivation that the United Nations, which normally has been talking about poverty and hunger in IMF-destroyed African countries, is just shocking. Why weren't there more MPs? Come to think of it, why wasn't Jeremy Corbyn in there?
Indeed, yeah, you see, that's a very good point, and that concerns me quite often with Corbyn, that his words are very good on these kind of issues, but you'd think to really sort of hammer home his position, he would be attending these debates. No, I mean, I'm in full agreement with you. I mean, as we discussed this before on Going Underground, and as I've said many a time, this is now the fifth report by the UN since June 2016, which has been absolutely scathing of successive governments this country and their treatment of some of the people on the bottom rungs, if you like, of our society. But
and I would also say that elites, they can live a kind of privatized space, so they can live in a private apartment block, they can take a private Uber car, they can drink private water, mineral water even, every aspect of their life. They don't need to even see any of this, maybe outside of the windows of a car. So perhaps that's the reason it's not really impacting on them. And of course, the media, the Netflix, all the rest of it in their lovely homes before they go to Parliament, they're not going to see these things. Although you'd think some MPs would be getting at their local surgeries, constituents telling them that relatives had died for want of welfare.
No, absolutely. Well, you would think that two homeless people dying within yards of Parliament in the past year would be enough for them, Ashton, but unfortunately, in this country, obviously not. And we're off to Sky News for this story, and this is a massive scoop by Sky. I sort of looked at it, and I thought, is that the Morning Star? They revealed that the government quietly awarded £75 million worth of Brexit-related contracts to some of the world's biggest consultancy firms. Now, the hoo-ha about this has been that it has been kept secret, and they hadn't made this information public, nor had they carried out an official procurement process to allow companies to tender bids for these contracts. But you see, for me, the big story of this is it sums up corporatism for me, but it also sums up the problem with Brexit. We're always stuck between a rock and a hard place, in so much that you're stuck with the corporatist EU, inherently driven by large banking organisations like Goldman Sachs, or alternatively, what was the other choice, the corporatist UK, driven by large banking organisations. With the Brexit vote, do you think that was the situation, or were you an arch Remainer, Ashton, and I just didn't know it?
Well, obviously, I have no views whatsoever, being Ofcom statutorily controlled.
We're not controlled by Ofcom here, so you are allowed to say what you want.
Oh, well, are we allowed to mention the names in this article? I mean, if I say none of them have made any admission of wrongdoing, and none is obviously implied the Canary Pod.
You are allowed to say what you want. This is classed as opinion, Afshin. So as long as we truly believe what we're saying, then we are fine. So
you see, that's just so utopian of you, Steve. I mean, really, we're allowed opinions. I tell you, the things that have been happening to me, my bank account was shut down. Anyway. If you're saying all of this is true, but I mean, Deloitte, Accenture, no, they said no money. At least they replied to Comcast, Sky, PwC. Bain McKinsey, yes, 25 McKinsey. Million to US firm. You know, a while back in a previous incarnation, I worked for a unnamed Middle Eastern government who made me set up a business station back in the days of the WTO riots in Seattle. And they eventually said, what sort of business station is this? That everyone else is showing stocks and shares and graphs, and you're just showing people on the street rioting. This isn't a business channel. But the point is, the leader of this Middle East country said, McKinsey, they're the ones always telling me that I've got to go to war with Iran or go to war with this country. These companies are very difficult to report on. So as you say, very good of Sky to do this. But it's very difficult with their armies of lawyers to get anything out of, say, PwC's relation to National Health Service contracts and PFI. Yes. And we had a source in one of these companies that's named in this story that had been earmarked for tens of millions of pounds for Brexit. Yeah, I mean, how can you? I mean, farcical, deep throat style Watergate things of having to meet people in car parks to try and get some information about National Health Service money and the reason that things were being sold off, National Health Service property was being sold off. Yeah. So, even away, I mean, of course, the Brexiteers would say that this does give us a chance to maybe nationalize these consulting firms or putting. Some firms, none of these ones, obviously, in the dock, because this is public money and this is our roads, our hospitals, our social housing, our social care, our meals on wheels. Why are these companies, undemocratic institutions, billions they're worth, involved in these things at all? Yeah. And I mean, the fact that Lord Kerslake, former head of civil service, who some might say is a particularly suspicious character in himself, he should express some doubt. Shows the seriousness of this, but I understand National Audit Office is now going to look into it.
They are indeed, and it will be very interesting to see what the National Audit Office comes up with. That segues us nicely into our final story, because the last one, which is the one Twitter decided for us, it kind of sums up where we're at with both the previous stories, actually. And it is, of course, the conclusion of the election expenses 2015 scandal. Now, apparently, the Electoral Commission has found that Margaret Little, a Conservative Party campaigner, was guilty of election fraud, and they've given her a 2-year suspended sentence. So one person has been found guilty after all these years of investigation. One woman has been made a scapegoat, with the judge saying there was a culture of sort of deception in Conservative Party headquarters, but obviously it wasn't intentional, because there hasn't been enough evidence to charge the Tories. Now, I mean, now this is over. Those lying, thieving, cheating Tories swindled the 2015 election. We all know it. The press know it, the Tories know it, and yet nothing is ever going to be done about it. But for me, it sums up the past two stories that we just discussed, because if the Tories hadn't fiddled the 2015 election, we might not be sitting here discussing the UN or Brexit at all. Do you think, Afshin, this should be one of the biggest stories of the decade that is effectively being brushed under the carpet now? Because it should be huge, surely.
No, I'm not sure. I think you're being mean to the Tories as well.
Really?
I mean, what is this? Election fraud in terms of a few extra leaflets, a coach full of activists? No, there's a much bigger election fraud going on here, which is that our entire information environment is absolutely full of neoliberal propaganda. Ah. I mean, I don't mind these Tories going in with a few extra leaflets and posters and a few extra people knocking on doors. No, the real thing here is much more serious. The whole perception of reality of people in this country ahead of that election was fundamentally wrong, and it probably started in the education system as to how capitalism actually works. So I'm not sure that's the election fraud to get at, actually, Steve.
I think, well, you see, now if we're talking in terms of that, I say that your take on this and that situation where corporatist capitalism infects every aspect of society and every aspect of our daily lives, creating us in turning us into a zombified, heaving mass of people who don't know our ass from our head. Then I'd say that was the biggest story of us as a species, Afshin, certainly. And I think that is the biggest challenge that we have ever faced. That we.
I mean, think of the election fraud about the environment, after all. I mean, I'm by the river here, and there's a reason why we aren't told about the lobbying of big fossil fuel companies affecting environment, because they are committing the biggest election fraud of them all.
Yep.
They're lobbying our MPs.
No, this is very true, absolutely. But no, okay, so you've persuaded me, I've changed my mind. Yes, I do agree with you that the real story is, of course, how corporatist capitalism subverts our every waking moment.
Wait, is that Steve Topple expressing sorrow and pity on the Tories?
watch this space. I couldn't possibly comment. I'll have to think about that. No, it is not. They still ripped off the 2015 election, however, whichever way you spin it. Afshin, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a real pleasure, and I look forward to seeing you again soon, where the tables will be turned back and I'll be facing a grilling from you.
See you on TV.
Afshin, thank you. Taking down this week's BBC QT, it's question time. Topple chirps back. I recoiled in horror watching this week's question time. Why, I hear you asking? Well, because Fiona Bruce was actually quite good. It was quite the revelation, wasn't it? She was actually quite persevering with questions of the Tory MP James Cleverly. Not so clever he is he? And there was something quite affable and amiable about her. She wasn't as staid and stoic as Dimblebot used to be. Obviously, her training at the BBC re-education camp didn't go according to plan, so I assume she will be taken back there at some point and given some more lessons, because at the minute, Fiona Bruce, thumbs up to you, doing quite a good job. Love it. Anyway, on with this week's questions. What do you have for me first off, question time?
Has the government lost control of the Brexit process?
No. The government has not lost control of the Brexit process. It never had control of the Brexit process in the first place. And I think this is the point the Labour Party is quite often missing in its narrative that it's peddling about the EU and the Brexit process. Labour Party wants a general election. They do well to put it to the public that the Conservatives never had control of this in the first place. And that is the problem with Brexit. It's not a question of whether we need to choose again, remain or leave. It's a question of, for the past 2 years, the people in charge of it have been in absolute meltdown. It's been chaotic, and that is the issue here. The people doing it are in the wrong. We need a change of hands to steer us through the process of leaving the EU. Simple as. Next question, please.
How do we make London's streets safe again?
I think to make our streets safer, what we need to do is acknowledge the root of the problem here, and that is the capitalist hierarchical society that we live in. Look, murders in London are terrible. Of course, it's awful that these things are happening, but historically, the murder rate was highest, that is the number of people murdered, along with the number of people murdered per 100,000 of the population, under Tony Blair in the noughties. So while this is still terrible, it is not as bad as it has been. However, of course, the issue here is, as I say, the system we live under. When you have a society which is driven by greed, driven by wanting more, driven by being better than the other people around you, having a better house, having a better car, having more money, then of course these things are going to happen. We're an inherently flawed society now, and unfortunately that is coming out in young people who, not least because of social media, but also because of the education system, feel there is no other options for them apart from to do crime. It's the societal structures in capitalism which causes such gaping inequality and causes people to feel they have no hope in life at all that we need to be addressing. There is no quick fix to this. Well, there is if you want a revolution. However, in my opinion, that's what needs to happen. Now, in honour of Fiona Bruce coming on board and hosting Question Time from the new year, I'm bringing a new section into this segment where I pose the questions that I would ask if I was a Question Time audience member. So, question number one. With Facebook announcing that it has signed secret agreements between it and smartphone manufacturers so people cannot remove the Facebook app from its phone, is 2019 going to be the year we see full corporate authoritarianism come to pass? Now, if you check out Nicola Jeffrey, my girlfriend's timeline on this, she's been banging on about what tech is doing to us as activists and as members of society for years. Check out the hashtag Activist Anomalies, and don't forget the shadow banning of disabled activists last year. I think 2019, we are going to see tech authoritarianism come full circle. And my second question is about the drone sightings at both Gatwick and Heathrow. Neither culprits have been found for these incidents, so I believe it does rather beg the question, and I have to say it, was this whole drone sighting at two major airports actually a government black op to test for flight chaos ahead of Brexit? Seem implausible? I'm not quite so sure it is. Think on that, people. Otherwise, until next week, question time, thank you so much. And here's this week's banger in Revolutionary Birdsong. I'm very excited once again on my podcast to have a very, very, very interesting guest, actually. Not that all my guests aren't interesting, of course, but this one is particularly interesting because this gentleman has made the move from political commentator, broadcaster and writer into the realms of music now, and he has made that transition absolutely stupendously smoothly. It is the wonderful, the legend, Mo Ansar. Mo, thank you so much for coming on Topple Uncaged.
Thank you very much. I don't know how smoothly it is exactly. Most of the scars are on the inside.
Well it was like a swan then, my friend, because you were perfectly graceful on the top, as it were. So you are the lead singer and all-round lead guy of Solomon, a band that was formed in Southampton several years ago. A few people came together at the Railway Inn in Winchester, I believe. You were on open mic nights and you all thought you should hook up and create this band, and members have changed over time, but I mean, it's had some amazing success actually, Mo. I've been following it closely and Solomon is doing really, really well. What inspired you, if you like, to go from the sort of political world where you were extremely well known to the world of music? What brought that about?
Yeah, it's funny. When you become a bit ubiquitous and you get up every morning and are doing the circuit of radio and TV interviews and you're popping up on The One Show and Newsnight, having a heart attack halfway through filming a 18-month documentary with Tommy Robinson will pretty much fucking floor anybody. In a nutshell, it would go something like this. I mean, I was, you know, working, I guess, in a journalistic and academic sphere. You know, I was lecturing on theology at the University of Winchester. I was lecturing on the PGCE and the BA Honours course. I was working in basically anything and everything I could get my hands on. A self-funded community organiser, so I was working on education, housing, health, homelessness, food banks. Obviously, when we met each other, it was the beginning, the tail end of Iraq, beginning end of austerity, and it was all getting into a very mishmashy, counter-extremist mess. We had terrorism going on, and a lot of us were looking at ourselves and trying to figure out who we are, and I ended up not by choice. I mean, who the bloody hell would ever choose that?
No,
you know, definitely. I ended up falling into the public eye. Twitter, I guess, grew up around me. I was the Muslim guy to speak to on everything.
You were actually, it's quite phenomenal.
And I didn't mind that. And I didn't mind that, tackling extremists, but also, you know, reaching out to people to build bridges. I've never been an extremist. I've never had an extremist mindset. So,
yeah, there was some shit thrown around about you.
Steve, I grew up on a council estate, all right? You know, it wasn't easy. I went to a grammar school. I was, you know, not let in. My parents, you know, my dad a butcher, my mum worked for the NHS. They had to appeal to get me in. So I had kind of a privileged education. So, you know, learning hasn't been difficult. Academia hasn't been difficult. But I tell you what, trying to forge a path in this world has been hard. So I, you know, went into religion, went into politics, went into education, tried to save the world on my own, which, of course, is really fucking stupid. Went pop, I guess, being very fat and carrying the world burdens on my shoulders, and decided to rebalance my life, reprioritize. So what do? Well, you do what every good John Hughes, AE's kid, who's ever watched a movie, is you be the lead singer of a rock and roll band.
And here we are.
And here we are. You saved the world of rock and roll magic.
I really, really, really like Solomon Band. It's a fascinating mix of, you've got sort of blues, folk, rock. It takes me back to sort of 90s sort of alternative, sort of prog rock almost. It's a really interesting sound. It's very unique, if you like. Where did this come about?
Well, I mean, it started out back in, I'd always been singing at school until the grammar school had the purge of all the Asian kids from the chamber choir, because we just were not going to look good that year standing in St. Michael's Church with all these little kind of ethnic minority faces. It looks so much better when you see carols from Kings, right? You know, you want them all looking, you know, kind of homogenous, right?
Of
so,
course.
I did the violin, I played the guitar, I was a fluent music reader at a young age at primary school. Then, like all good teenagers, you just forget all that stuff. You lose it all. I got to a situation where I was starting to do music again, even though ostensibly to the outside world, I was this, you know, very beard, hat and robes, Muslimy guy. I had a very musical, artistic, I guess, private life. All of this, of course, unbeknown, because all you know is you grew up in an Asian community in council estate, and music is bad or frowned upon. We have this conflict. We have this irreconcilable gap, which is, so Muslims were the first troubadours traveling around Europe, carrying folk music and tales of peace, hope and change. We put six strings on a guitar. We put together the collection of chords and musical families and notations. And now we are somehow, what, against music or rock and roll magic? I think it's absurd. I started out just doing very folky, plucky stuff. And then you meet musicians and you start learning to play music with other people. I met the fabulous Canadian violinist Miranda Mulholland, and we did a live recording at the Railway in Winchester. And then I played with other musicians, and now I'm a bit like Man City or Liverpool. I've got a big squad, and I pick a lineup, and we have a lineup for any certain day. But keeping the band together, our rock and roll lifestyles, the craziness, the adventures, all of the silly things, the music for once is fantastic. There's no question about the music. Everybody brings their bit. Mo writes, does the melodies. We all chuck it together. We thrash it out on the live circuit, and we just do 3-4 gigs a week. hammering. So we've racked up so many miles in 3 or 4 years. It's been unbelievable.
One of the standout tracks you did was New Tomorrow, which kind of, it was almost a bit sort of Celtic in its yeah. inspiration. It was really, really beautiful in a minor key. It was a really beautiful track. Now, I obviously heard the studio version of that. However, how has that morphed, as you say, on the live circuit? Because you guys are prolific live. You are constantly gigging. You're always all over the place. It's brilliant to see. So how do songs like New Tomorrow, how do they change when you perform them live?
Let's talk about the pink elephant in the room, okay, which is the hashtag Mo CV. All right, so for years, the likes of Louise Mensch and, you know, when I met David Aronovich, he became one of my biggest critics, right? But he took me to lunch, the sneaky so-and-so, got to know me and realised that, yeah, I am a bit weird. I do all this stuff. I am one of these idiot dreamer, hopeful believers that went on the one show and was told, whatever you do, don't hug Alex. Don't be huggy, kissy, touchy-feely Mo. Be austere Muslim emo, right? And I'm like, will you guys stop shaping me? Let me be myself. So, the music started out with me wanting to literally go on a musical journey. I wanted to do the real thing, all right? It wasn't going to be bullshit. And I wanted it to be genuine. If you've got coronary artery disease and you've lived 15, 20 years clean, no sex, drugs, rock and roll, and suddenly you decide you've got a new lease at life and you want to actually be a musician, you want it to be authentic, I guess you kind of have to go immersive. If you want to be a musician, don't pretend to be a musician. Mm. After I did the thing which went a bit viral with Katie first time round or second time round, which was about obviously immigration and Syria and refugees, I just decided enough of this shit. There's got to be something more than me being lined up as the knockout guy, just to knock out a never-ending line of racists and Islamophobes in the current climate. You become the thing that you don't want to be, which is just a weapon of choice. Mm. And I have something more to say. I want something more. And why not try and reach people through music? So I started writing the music, New Tomorrow, a few other things about my view on the world and my politics and faith and spirituality and just general stuff. And as I met musicians, they bring something to the table. But the live scene in Southampton, there's a phenomenal music scene here. It goes unrecognised largely. When I turned up doing music in Southampton, I was like, so where's this rock and roll scene? And it wasn't there. And I thought, right, we'll sod it then. We will make one and we will do one and we will create a movement and we will work with people and bring a massive family. It's like a Tolstoy novel with a... I have no idea who 95% of my private friends on Facebook are now. But it's great. It's been great adventures.
So, Paul Solomon, what has 2019 got in store for you, Mo? Because, I mean, you were mad busy last year, so I can only imagine what's going to be going on this year.
Yeah, so we did a load of headliners for the Labour Party, for the unions, because as an activist, you'd catch me in the back of the bus or the coach going to demos and People's Assembly and Momentum things, sort of singing songs, which I didn't really know. Apparently some guy called Bob Dylan and other people.
Never heard of him.
No, never heard of him. I mean, as a journo campaigner type, I mean, what the hell do we know about music, right?
Right.
So I think for the first time I feel battle battle hardened and okay. and battle weary. So it's for the first few weeks this year, first month or two, I'm going to take sabbatical, collect myself, regroup. I'd like to do some more stuff for the Labour Party. Jeremy's doing great. I think change is a coming. Changes are coming, and we have fought hard for this change.
If you want to know more about Solomon, the details will be in the show notes. Mo, it was such a pleasure to talk to you. Really, really, really enjoyed that. That was great. Thank you so much, Mo and Sar.
Thank you very much. Love you, Steve. Love you guys.
Love you too. And so from Solomon, here is the fantastic track me and Mo were talking about earlier. It is New Tomorrow, Solomon. New Tomorrow.
So
And that's it. Episode 9 of Topple Uncaged is done. I would like to thank my fantastic guest, the legendary Afshin Ratanzi. Follow him on Twitter. It's at Afshin Ratanzi. And the delicious Mo Ansar. Follow him on Twitter. It's at Mo Ansar. Behind the scenes, as always, thank you to the gorgeous Nicola Jeffrey. Follow her on Twitter. It's at Nicola C. Jeffrey. Thank you as well this week to Gav Pause, my sound engineer. Follow him on Twitter. It's at Pause with Z Radio. Also, as always, thank you to my in-house singer. It's Ray Star Music. Follow her on Twitter. It's at Ray underscore star 113. And last but not least, thank you to Canary for uncaging me. Don't forget to join us. More details, www.thecanary.co. Otherwise, that's it for another week. Ta-ta for now.
Uncaged.